Good evening, Larry. How's it going?
Oh, doing okay, Andy. What's going on in the eastern half of the United States?
It's actually kind of cold and it's kind of in the south too. It's supposed to be in the high 30s in the morning.
That's fantastic.
All right, I want to try something out. I haven't even prepped you for this one. Are you ready?
I'm ready for anything.
Recording live from FYP Studios, transmitting across the internet. This is Registry Matters.
Wow, I love it.
Do you? So we should keep that?
I think we should keep it.
Yeah, I'm gonna clean, tighten it up and figure out the way that I want to do it. But I figured I'd launch that with you tonight.
All right.
All right. Well, so there's that, and we did get a new patron this week, and we would like to welcome and thank Laura. She comes in at the hustler level with actually a little added bonus. Thank you so very much, Laura. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. She actually threw a pretty long email message at us. And it's from the one that we released last week. And she goes, "Hi, this is the first podcast I've listened to on Registry Matters. I want to thank you too for the hard work that I know goes into the podcast, the research and the time. The articles discussed tonight really struck a nerve and I could relate with them. It's clear to see that there's something fundamentally wrong with this country's justice system as a whole. Far beyond the issues surrounding the registry, you are right when you said that parole and probation has become an industry, a business. In my opinion, the whole system has become big business. Majority of the time, it's not just about justice, it's about the win. For them, judges, attorneys, prosecutors, treatment providers, and probation officers disregarding the Constitution in order to serve their agenda, which is politically and financially motivated, disregarding our rights by placing arbitrary rules and restrictions that further support their agenda. Okay, that's my vent for this evening. Thank you for reading. I hope your podcast continues to grow in numbers and you are able to reach more people. Not only those who are affected directly by the registry, but also those who seek and need education on what's going on. I appreciate the two of you and the work and support your work. Great job, guys. Thank you." Well, I think that was a pretty well-written email.
That was really nice of Laura to say that. And where is what region and what the location? We have to send out some blue balls.
She's in the northwest part of Georgia.
Wow. And the Northwest, like Walker County and places like that are really, really.
I couldn't speak specifically to the county. I know that she's up that way somewhere.
Yeah, well, there's some really, really outlying political views up in Northwest Georgia.
Do we need to start playing dueling banjos? Is that what you're saying? Do we need to bring in Deliverance?
I don't know about that, but yes, that's a very conservative part of the state. I mean, Georgia is largely conservative except for the urban areas, but that's a particularly conservative part of the state.
Definitely that. God, I really, really, really shouldn't do this. That's enough of that. Enough of that tangent. Yeah, that's now, in my opinion, that's what I think of when I think of Northwest Georgia.
Well, Georgia is maturing politically. I mean, just look at the last election.
This election was interesting. Do you want to touch that first before we go on?
Sure. We had the impossible almost achieved in the Peach State. We had a Democrat, which I think no Democrat has won statewide office since 1998, so we're looking at 20 years. We had a Democrat, a minority Democrat, an African-American Democrat woman who is within a half a point of the winning the governorship, and there's still ballots that haven't been counted, and there was a fair amount of what objective reporting says was voter suppression by the opponent, who is the current Secretary of State of Georgia until a couple of days ago when he stepped down after managing the suppressive efforts. And I think I sent you a video today showing that there were like hundreds and hundreds of voting machines that were not used in the Fulton, and DeKalb was the guy.
Yeah, he didn't pronounce it right.
That would be DeKalb County for those of you who live in Georgia, but there were extremely long lines, hours and hours in those counties where people did not vote and walked away. And there was no way of knowing how many people would have voted for whom. But what we do know is that those areas are very Democratic in terms of their voting participation. They vote overwhelmingly Democratic. So we could conclude from the evidence of the final vote that did get recorded that, assuming they would have voted in the same ratios, that there would have been a whole lot more votes for Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate.
Is there any way to objectively look at what Kemp did as being the Secretary of State who is running the election? Is there any way to objectively look at that and say that he didn't have a way to put his finger on the scale somehow?
Well, I don't know all the powers that a Secretary of State has in that state, but I do know they have enormous powers in terms of election, how they allocate voting machines in terms of training their county clerks and the processes of approving the ballot. I know they approve the ballot here in my state. There's a lot going on. And like, for example, if we move down to Florida, you had a dramatic undervote in the Senate race, which is highly competitive between Nelson, the Democrat. There was a significant undervote. And if the Secretary of State deliberately approved a ballot that was confusing and would have left off, made it difficult to notice that there was another office on there. And I haven't seen the Florida ballot, so we don't need 100 emails saying you don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about because I haven't seen the ballot, but I do know that the reporting has been that there was a significant undervote. And usually the undervote, which is no voting on that particular office, doesn't occur on the high level offices. You're going to get an undervote as you go down the ballot where people don't know anything. They haven't heard of those people. I can assure you that most everybody in Florida that's voting has probably heard of Senator Nelson. And I assure you that the opponent, which was Governor Scott, they've probably heard of Governor Scott.
So likely.
It doesn't seem like that would be an office where you would have an undervote. You would have an undervote for a county commission race or a city council race or a school board race or something where it's just not people say, well, who are these candidates? I'm not going to vote for either one of them. But that's not where you would have an undervote. And there were tens of thousands of undervote, particularly in South Florida, again, in a more Democratic area of the state. So it's very, very peculiar what goes on in these states. And Florida, as you know, was the home of the debacle in 2000.
Hanging Chad. With
the recount that was stopped by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. And so the following morning, Wednesday morning, you called me and you were all elated that you predicted it right. But even after that, there were two Senate races that flipped the other way after further ballot counting.
Well, I'm familiar with Arizona where the ahead. I don't know of another one that's flipped yet, but this Nelson Scott race in Florida.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of.
It could potentially. And then there's a runoff in Mississippi, which no one in their right mind actually thinks the Democrats going to win in Mississippi. Of course, no one in their right mind thought that Doug Jones was going to win in Alabama either, or the vacant Senate seat when he ran against very flawed candidate that had been kicked off the Supreme Court twice and had allegations of sexual impropriety going back for decades, which on this podcast we defended that was impossible. We said that was not fair to bring that into the election all these decades later.
Certainly.
Even though I detest the man's politics, I didn't think that was fair.
Absolutely. What do you think then? Okay, so the Democrats have taken the House and then the Republicans have a teeny little bit stronger of a majority in the Senate. What does that do for us?
It's hard to say what it does for us when you say us in terms of criminal justice or us specifically, those who are required to register.
I would definitely put it both. Because you know, we could talk about Prop 4 down in Florida where they put about a million whatever people back on the voter registration by letting convicted felons minus murder and sex offenses back on the ability to vote.
Yeah, we got that covered later in the podcast.
Correct.
But in terms of what it does is it creates the opportunity to temper the extreme agenda, which some of our listeners will think that we're the extreme ones because we're libtards. I think that what's been going on the last couple of years in terms of the massive expansion of prosecutorial efforts, and we're going to get into that later in the podcast, but what damage that the Attorney General Sessions has done, I happen to think that that extreme agenda will possibly be tempered, because it'll be very difficult to get anything through that's going to crack down any further. Of course, we're already too harsh in America to begin with, in terms, but it's going to be very difficult to get anything through to make our already harsh penalty scheme at the federal level any harsher than what it already is. I don't expect it to have magically, there'll be great progress. If there truly were a reform bill, which Jared Kushner is pushing, which is Trump's nephew, who's an advisor, senior
son-in-law.
Excuse me. I got old timers, you know. Jared Kushner, who's pushing for criminal justice reform, it will clear the decks to make that more possible, because each time criminal justice reform is talked about, the conservatives block it, as they did again this year. They said, we'll take it up after the elections. In the meantime, they vilified every Democrat that they're running against, saying how soft they were on crime and they were turning loose a tidal wave of criminality on the country. It'll make it more feasible to get that through. But with it goes risk, because 2 years later, since the entire House is up for re-election every 2 years, the vilification will start all over again for anybody who voted for criminal justice reform. It's a given that that's going to happen, that you get vilified for wanting to do things. Just in our state, the governor has expressed, our governor-elect, she's not quite in office yet, but she had expressed that life with parole after 30 years, that they should at least be given a reason they're denied. Under the current administration, they just routinely deny them after 30 years. You've been perfect in prison. And she had the audacity to say, well, they should at least be given a reason if they're denied. And they ran relentless attacks on her about how she was wanting to parole murderers. Well, first of all, parole murderers have a very low recidivism rate. But she wasn't saying that at all. She was saying that they deserve to be told why they're not being paroled after 30 years of good behavior. I mean, can't we agree on that? If you behave yourself for 30 years and take advantage of whatever meager rehabilitation is offered, that after 30 years that you ought at least be told a reason why we're keeping you in a cage?
I don't even understand the reason to keep him in a cage after that long period. Forget giving them a reason why we're going to keep you in there.
Well, there'd be some people you'd understand it. With Manson, you probably would understand keeping him in the cage for beyond the 30 years. But some of these people, these crimes that they're deserving of at least consideration without sure. Summarily being rejected.
Otherwise, that's what Rick Scott was doing. They had their procedure, whatever, where you would go stand in front of him and just time after time after time. What's his name? John Oliver did a segment about it, and they just showed clip after clip. He's like, thank you for coming in. Sorry, not going to do it. And just dozens of people had been released out of thousands that had applied. It's just ridiculous, man.
Very, very, very small number.
Yeah. The federal judge side, we're still, it's still in the Republicans' hands to elect the most conservative as far as they want. There's even less to stop them on that side. But I guess there now has to be some level of negotiation between the two houses. And this only matters at the federal level. But you know, down at your state level, there was a lot of stuff that moved left on the state level, and that could be good for us.
Could be. And even on the federal level, in terms of budget priorities, the fact that the Democratic Party is in control of the House, Trump will probably continue to heap tens and tens of billions of dollars into the military. But he will have to balance that with increased spending in other areas if he's going to get those tens of billions of dollars, because otherwise he's going to run up against a wall of resistance on the Democratic side to just massively increase spending for his priorities. He's probably not likely to get the border wall with the Democratic House. I'd say it would be very, very tough, even in the best of scenarios, of what he would be willing to compromise to do to get his border wall. He's going to have to do a lot more compromising to get right. His agenda through the House. It, like on the agriculture bill, on the where it may help would be if they don't do this, there's the it gets complicated. But the,
yeah, I know.
The budget for the fiscal year that started October 1st, we don't have a budget for all of, I believe there's 13 separate appropriation bills, and we're operating under what's called a continuing resolution, which is, will authorize the continuation of spending at the previous year's levels. And a CR, as it's called. Well, they're going back into a lame duck session where they're going to try to adopt a budget. The agriculture department does food stamps. That's one of the things within the food nutrition area that's in the farm bill. And if they can't come to an agreement, the conference committee, where there's two different versions, there's a Senate version and a House version, if they can't come to an agreement, then they'll probably have to do another continuing resolution until after the first of the year. Well, when you get Democratic control, it's going to be tougher to get that really harsh House language to stand, because they're still going to need a farm bill, and you're going to be dealing with all Democratic committee chairs, as I've said previous podcasts, for those who've just joined the first time. When you have the majority, that gives you all the committee chairmanships. It gives you the control of the calendar, and the whether it be Speaker Pelosi or whoever the Democrats may choose, the House will be run by the Democratic Party starting in January 3rd when they swear in the new Congress, and that's going to be a whole different ballgame for Mr. Trump to have to deal with.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to get into the whole Mueller investigation on that side too. All right. I ended up texting with one of our listeners, an avid listener and someone that promotes the podcast a lot. And he's Jeff from Kentucky. And he ultimately told me, he said, "You and Larry always are saying to quit sitting idly by, letting people do it for you got me inspired. I'm now a monetary contributor to NARSAL, and now I'm also a state contact for Kentucky that represents NARSAL. I think I'll be answering questions for Kentucky residents about laws via email. I'm slowly getting into the fight. After I get my feet wet and kind of understand what I'm supposed to be doing, I plan to eventually move up to full-on advocate, and I will be going to the state capitol and talking to state legislators about these silly laws they like to pass." I thought that was a highly, highly, highly inspiring text message thread that I had with Jeff, and I really, really appreciate that we've been able to inspire someone to move up in the world of advocacy.
We only have 900,000 to go now.
Absolutely. So thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate that, and keep up the great work.
And thank you, Jeff, from NARSAL. We know that you're there, and it's going to be a learning curve, and people want to go to lunch and learn all this, and it's a lifetime for me to understand as well as I do, and I still learn regularly. So you don't know it all.
Absolutely. Let's move over to a voicemail from Chuck in New York.
"How can the authorities here in the United States get away with banning registrants from nursing homes, from senior living facilities? There was that gentleman who lived in a tent in Florida who couldn't live at his wife's house and was stuck in the woods with an oxygen tank and an oxygen mask. And then there's people who are found eligible, ineligible for housing for people with disabilities because of their status on a registry. And I just think it's real harsh. And if there's anyone out there who's interested in starting up a group, please let me know. I would like to start up a group for people who have disabilities, who are senior citizens, who are on the registry and have had issues where they've been banned or barred from taking part in activities or specialized housing or things like that. So I don't know, but I just think it's disgusting, disgraceful, outrageous, just horrific and shocking that this is allowed to happen. It's just disgusting. There's people that have been waiting on housing lists for more than 10 years to get specialized housing for the disabled, for example, and then to receive a note that they can't get that housing because of the registry. It's just disgusting. It really is.
What do you think?
I agree with Charles that it's shocking, appalling, and I think I could even agree with disgusting that happens. And how they do it, Charles, is because the laws are passed by the people we elect, and they're presumed constitutional and valid because every legislative enactment is presumed constitutional until there's a challenge, and the challenger bears the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the lawmakers got it wrong. And a policy you disagree with or a law you disagree with is not magically unconstitutional just because you disagree with it. It's a very enormous hill to climb when you're challenging the constitutionality of something. And too many of our people think merely not liking it is enough. And I think they get that impression from watching TV when they hear of these injunctions issued on things real quickly after they're about to go into effect or have gone into effect. And that's because there's money out there to challenge those. There are organizations ready, and they have lawyers who've researched the issues from a constitutional perspective, and they have the ability to move into action fairly quickly. We don't have such a resource. The Koch brothers are not funding us to do these types of challenges. There's a lot of things that we believe would succumb to constitutional challenge if we had the proper resources. But in our capitalist system, we don't have those resources, because when you approach the foundations for money, they don't seem to want to give to the sex offender cause to protect their rights. When you approach the individuals who are on the registry, they either don't have the money or they're not willing to fund it. And we end up with very meager resources, with hundreds of things that need to be challenged and enough resources to challenge a very, very slim amount of what's out there that's potentially vulnerable to challenge. So that's the answer I have. I agree.
And when you say something that's vulnerable, it would seem to me that, I mean, these aren't like massive, massive, massive battles. Think of an abortion debate, think of same-sex marriage debate. Those would have to be, or, you know, like universal healthcare of some kind. Those would be massive, massive things. Many of our things, first of all, they're at a state level, and they probably would be fairly, I don't want to say just small, but they would not rise to that level by any means. Maybe $20,000 or $30,000 would be all it would take to fund a challenge.
There would be many cases where that would be enough. But you get into the thing, like, for example, the denial of housing. Is that, do you have a constitutional right to housing?
Well, you do not, unfortunately.
Well, but then again, do you have the right to equal protection under the Constitution when they have housing eligibility criteria, for example, like on the food stamps, which the Holding Amendment is trying to expand the prohibitions? Do you have the right to food stamps? No, you don't. But if it's an entitlement based on eligibility standards that all other eligibility criteria is met, can you just eliminate entire subgroups of the population willy-nilly? Well, we don't know the answer to those questions. They haven't been posed and taken up on appeal, so we don't know whether you can do it or not. We do know you can do it until you're stopped.
Yeah. We talk about that quite often.
But we don't know what a well-funded challenge would be on the SNAP benefits if the resources were able to be mustered and say, I'm sorry, Mr. President, you've signed this into law, but we're taking it to court and we're seeking injunctive relief right away because you can't do this. I don't know. I haven't researched it, but it seems like to me there could be some credible arguments made about at least compelling enough that you wouldn't get laughed out of court in terms of the right that you might have under the SNAP benefit program to not be denied arbitrarily. But it certainly says something about who we are as a nation to imagine that we would tell a person, we understand you're hungry. We understand that you meet all the eligibility requirements. We understand you made a mistake in 1997. Therefore, starve. I mean, doesn't that say something about who we are?
I was just going to go there. It's not constitutionally protected. However, we as a people have decided that there are certain people that we are just going to say, F off. You don't get housing or food. Figure it out.
It really says something to me about what this nation that prides itself on being. I've grown up and decades, we're the kindest, most generous, compassionate people on earth. And we reinforce that to our children. We're the kindest, most compassionate, generous nation on earth. Do you really think you are?
We also then received an email message. So last week I made a comment about there being, you know, we were talking about the unemployment rate being so low and that it seems like it'd be pretty easy for people to find jobs. And, you know, I'm coming from an IT background, and a couple of people wrote in, somebody left a comment on the website, and then we also received this email message. I was in IT as well. Now I work in a warehouse as a general laborer. Thanks to them not doing a background check. I applied, interviewed at about a dozen temp agencies over a large geographic area, with only one being willing to work with me once they found out that I'm on the registry. Your best bet may be to be a consultant working for a company that you or others create the company as a full business, not doing its business as, not like a sole proprietorship. Avoid any business that demands background checks of the consultants. Your state and county or probation officer may nix that, though, so take my idea with a grain of salt. Another possibility is to do remote support and very slowly build up a reputation and client base. As for me, I've pretty much given up on IT at this point. My only hope is to get hired on by a business, temp to hire, and eventually move into an IT position. Yeah, I totally get the sentiment that it seems like in almost all jobs, as soon as you reveal that you're on the registry, you're going to get shut down in many, many cases. What do you think people should do?
I wish I had an answer to that question. He gives good suggestions about create your own business. A lot of POs do nix that because they don't have the capacity to supervise the person as well, unless it's a home-based business where you never leave home for the most part. But if you're going to be in a service business, then you're typically going to be nixed oftentimes. We can't have you out traveling unsupervised and going into businesses and homes where we don't know where you are. Well, that's what GPS technology does. It allows you to know where they went. But for whatever the reasons are, that is a big problem for the supervised population.
And then a voicemail message from Will in Tennessee.
And you're also right about the fact that getting, you know, having the resources to fight it is the problem. And that's why so many of these rules in states like Tennessee stand, is because most of us have a hard time finding a job. If the record doesn't stop us, then the restrictions as to where we can even look for work come into play. And you can only get it. You can only have as much justice in this world as you can afford to pay for, which I think is kind of a crock, but that's a discussion for another day.
So that was from Will in Tennessee, and it kind of ties into the same thing that I was just talking about with the IT position. But I think you have some ideas about the justice for people with money.
Well, it's sadly true. It's tragically true, but that's the reality of our capitalist system, and I'm not advising that there's a better system out there, but we can strive to make our system better if we're allowed to say that it has imperfections that need to be addressed. But in capitalism, you get better schools, you get better clothing, you get better medical care, you get better everything if you have money. It would only stand to reason that you would get better attorneys if you get better everything else, if you have money. What would magically be different about the legal profession that you would get as good an attorney with no money as you would get with money? When I can't think of anything else that you get just as well, that's just as good if you have no money. Can you, Andy? Is there anything that you get served up in this capitalist system that's just as good if you don't have money?
No, and I immediately just revert to O.J. Simpson. He probably paid, how much did Johnny Cochran cost? Like $4 million or some silly number like that?
It would have been astronomical even for that time frame of mid-1990s. But he's right. It's a crock. It's sad. But what do we do about it? I just about bet you if you go out and start approaching your elected legislators in Tennessee, and I'm going to pick on Wisconsin in just a minute here in the same response. But when you go out and start saying, I'd like to increase what we pay for our public defenders, assuming you have a state-funded system in Tennessee, and I don't know, you may have a county-based system. But just revert from legislators to county commissioners if you have a county-based system. Go and approach them and tell them, I would like to propose that we increase dramatically the funding for defender services in this country, in this county, in this state, for those accused of crimes, and tell me what the reaction is. Or even better yet, go to a civic group, go to a neighborhood association where there's an elected official speaking, and raise your hand when they call on public questions and say, I've got a priority of what I'd like to do. I want to see more money put in energy defense, and tell me what happens and how much applause you get.
I'm thinking you're going to get a lot of tomatoes.
You'd be lucky if you, if that's all you get, because if you're serving in the state legislature, you've got so many things that are competing for money that you're having to fund. Usually the states are involved in education. They're involved in prisons. They're involved in the judicial branch for administration of justice. They're involved in roads and bridges and environmental control and public health. There's all these things competing for money. And prisoners, their needs, they'll fund building more prisoners. But as far as trying to provide for prisoner needs or those accused of crimes, that's just very low on the totem pole. It's just not going to get the public support. And in fact, when I said I was going to circle back to Wisconsin, there's a battle up there. They're paying attorneys $40 an hour in court and $25 an hour out of court. Now, this is people who have under contract. They are, you know, the judges. There's been a lot of litigation, which I haven't been able to follow at all. But they're paying people $25 an hour for their out-of-court work. For an attorney. Now tell me, when's the last time you've had an attorney quote a rate of $25 to $40 an hour?
Yeah, isn't it normally around $100, $150, $200?
That's on the low side, yes. So $100 okay. is kind of outdated, but yeah, you get $200 plus hourly rates. Now, no one collects that in indigent defense, because I'm not aware of any county or state system that pays anywhere near $200 an hour. Even the feds, which is the best paying system under the Criminal Justice Act, they pay in the $100, $125 range. Perhaps maybe in San Francisco and some high cost jurisdictions, maybe the CJA panel attorneys on the A panel get more. But we don't want to spend our tax resources in this country on indigent defense, Will. That's just the bottom line. That's not a priority for us. So unfortunately, the resources are not there. And then what he's wanting to do is he wants to initiate civil challenges. And
right.
There's basically nothing for civil challenges. I mean, we've all but gutted indigent for civil action, because that's something that's just not a priority at all. I mean, the Legal Service Corporation, the federal funding has all but evaporated from that. It's kind of like the public broadcasting system. We don't value what those type of things. I mean, we'd rather give. Well, I'll stop.
Yeah, I understand. Well, let's move on to something a little bit lighthearted. We have a listener up there in Nebraska with the other four people that live there, and he keeps sending in pictures. I sent him a bunch of our famous blue balls. And the picture this week, I just wanted to highlight it because I keep meaning to do this, is there's a bunch of blue balls that are tailgating as they're going down the street. I just wanted to bring that up. They're kind of funny. So, you know, four blue balls. Go look at the website. Go check out the show notes so you can see the picture. I'll put it up there as the feature image. So there's four blue balls like on a little paper road, whatever, and they're all like kind of humping each other, so to speak.
You
all right, you ready to cover some articles?
Yeah, let's have fun.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. Do you remember the chanting people around the guy's house a couple weeks ago?
That was up in Rhode Island. Yes, I do.
That was. This guy's been arrested for... If the guy did this on purpose, he's a moron. But I got to think that it was... I don't know. Anyway, guy does a bunch of years. I think he did 30 years. He goes to register for a marriage license and he lists something that's a different address than his address. So they got him on a technical for trying to like do some fraudulent documentation to a government official. So it's from the Providence Journal. It's Cranston police arrest registered sex offender Richard Gardner. To me, it just feels like they're just looking for a way to get this guy out of their city.
That is exactly what they're doing. And those few listeners we have in New Mexico, they'll remember this case if I remind them of the name Siebers. Can't remember Siebers' first name, but he moved here back in the late 99, 2000, early 2000 range, and they were trying to run him out of the territory. And the mayor took a special interest in him because he was a level 3 sex offender from Michigan, I believe. And he harassed and hounded him. They didn't file any charges on him, but his house got burned. His mobile home got burned. They hounded him until he moved out of the territory. And he's still in the state. He's up in the East Mountains. But that's what's happening here. I can understand the guy giving the address. If you move to a place new and you're not sure you're going to be permanently there, I can see you listing what you consider a permanent address. If there's anybody who can say that they've never given their parents' address, they've never given what they thought was a more permanent address on something, I think you'd be a little bit disingenuous to say that you've never done that, particularly if you don't think you're stable at the address that you're at.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're going to have your mail delivered, and then you got 17 forwarding address cards around, and you never get your mail. So you list some place as a semi-permanent place that you can reliably go get your mails, as an example.
That is exactly right. And this is a case where the substitute, where it was our mayor, substitute the sheriff, that jurisdiction. They're trying to write him out of the territory. That's what they're trying to do. And
we're not just being libtards and trying to be bleeding heart liberals and cutting the guy a bunch of slack. This guy is like totally a monster, and he's trying to circumvent the system, and he needs to be locked back up. Is that the counterpoint?
Well, that's what they're saying, but he's done his time. He may be a monster. We don't know. But when you do your time, if you're a monster, you still get to go on with your life. So he has a right to go live in Rhode Island if he's free of all supervision requirements. And if he's a monster, so be it. When he commits a sex offense again, they can lock him up again.
He is still on 30 years of probation.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he did 20, and then he's on 30 years of probation. I mean, I don't. It still seems like it seems a bit of a witch hunt. I mean, they had a few dozen people protesting outside of his house, telling him to get out of town.
So it's sad, but even if he's got probation, he's trying to apparently follow the law. But we've got officials there who say that they don't want him there.
Yeah. And I mean, is it within, I can see the conservative side of it, that you should be able to stake your claim, put your flag in the ground.
And under the terms of this, he's not allowed in Massachusetts now. How can they keep him out of Massachusetts? Isn't that the source of his probation?
Yeah, I don't know. When I was reading that,
if I understand his convictions out of Massachusetts, I don't know how you can, I mean, he would need permission, but I don't know how you can ban a person from being in the state they were convicted in. That would be banishment. And that would qualify as banishment.
Well, let's move on to the next article. This one, there's this woman, I don't even know where this actually happens, but she has a miscarriage, and I can see that would be sort of like, you're kind of freaked out, you were very, very excited about having your baby, and then you end up having a miscarriage. So at the hospital, she kidnaps a baby. I totally see that she's done something wrong. I gotta think that a judge would be like, I see that you were under some stress. I don't really think that you should get a whole lot of sentence out of this, and I certainly don't see that you would end up on the registry. So then this happened. When did this happen?
20 years ago.
All right. So 20 years ago, so she has this situation come up. So now she's in her 30s, I would guess. And then she goes to register her current kids at the local daycare, but because she's on the registry, because she kidnapped a baby from the – I know that that's a horrific thing that would have happened, but how do you end up on the sex offender registry? And then – so now she gets arrested because she tries to go register her kids at daycare. Title of the article is Prosecutor, Woman Broke Sex Offender Law After Registering Children at Daycare. This is nuts.
Joliet is generally Illinois, I would think, and that's okay. Where this is from.
I'll take your word for it.
That's and they're holding her on a very high bond,
150. Yeah, 150 grand.
She can't make, which is another thing that Charles and people who talk about the American system of justice, does having cash somehow make you less of a danger? Having access to financial resources, otherwise you get to sit in jail and await trial. But she has, so the state of Illinois, assuming there's not another Juliet, the state of Illinois is going to spend money prosecuting her. They're going to have to take her children into custody and foster care is already in short supply. They're very difficult placing foster children, which means that they're going to be spending a lot of money, because she was trying, I'm assuming, to put her children in care so that she could be more productive. To me, that makes perfect sense. I don't know why do you even have this article in here?
Because, of course, the state's going to raise the kids better than the parents would.
Yes. But there again, they're in the catch-22, because usually these authorities don't like these children being dumped on them. They just have no choice when they're brought to them. But the
I gotta think that foster care, I mean, that is not like that is a like a end all. That's the last situation, a last resort to catch this kind of situation from mom and dad. They're dealing cocaine. They're not fit to be parents and so forth. I don't think that that's what this situation is. Foster care is not a very, you know, that's like using a shotgun approach to solve a problem instead of like actually fine tuning something to fix a problem. This woman doesn't need to be locked up.
Well, according to the prosecutor there, she does. He's very adamant, according to this article. Will County State's Attorney John Rickman told Judge Carlson during court here on September 25th that Mitchell went to the kinder care to register her children, and the staff knew of her sex offender status. A warrant was issued. She was charged being in a school zone. She was apprehended on September 21st. She's locked up in the Will County Jail since then on a $150,000 bond. And she'll need at least 10%, which is $15,000. The average American doesn't have that kind of money. And the state's attorney spokesman said the office objects to Mitchell's bond being reduced because of her past criminal history and current charges. Now, as you agree, you said, and I agree, that kidnapping a baby is probably not behavior we'd want to condone. But it was 20 years ago. Now she has her own children. She's probably not in the kidnapping business any longer.
But I'm also like, I'm considering like the situation. She had a miscarriage. She was probably very distraught, and she just acted like, oh my God, I have to have a baby. I need my baby. So she grabs one. Not condone it, but like, yeah, I could kind of see you lose your brain a little bit and you make an irrational decision.
Yes. Well, that was, she served 13, she was sentenced to 13 years. I don't know what she actually served.
Sure.
She was sentenced to 13 years in prison. And then the registration follows, because the kidnapping a child would subject people to registration. Now, in my state, it has to be with a sexual motivation. We've changed that law. Okay. We used to have it just kidnapping, and that's been changed. But it's tragic, and this is an example of what Charles was talking about. How can they do that? Well, because the public supports it. That's how they can do that. You would think that if we were fiscally as conservative and worried about the resource issue, that we'd be calling that Will County Prosecutor's Office and saying, come on, man, do you really want to be spending all this money prosecuting her and for the state to have to raise her children?
And I grabbed a comment. A lady wrote, her name's Clara. She said, sort of ironic that the registry is touted as if it saves just one child. Yet in this case, they are harming her children. They've been taken away from their mother. They're displaced from their home, and they've been ostracized due to their mom's momentary lapse in judgments, which had nothing to do with sex. How is this helping anyone? To those meddling kinder care staff members, karma will one day come knock on your door.
I wish I had the answer.
That one's that one just makes me kind of sad. Larry, tell me about the Attorney General.
The United States Attorney General, is that who you're talking about?
That would be the one, Jeff Sessions, Senator, correct?
Former Alabama Attorney General, former senator from Alabama. One was the first sitting senator to endorse Donald Trump for president.
I believe that's correct.
And he was rewarded with the Attorney General, which is a coveted position. That being a U.S. Attorney General is pretty high on the pecking order.
Yeah, sure.
Of that and Secretary of State, and you know, these offices are significant. But Mr. Sessions was asked for and received his resignation last week. The day after the election, I believe, is when it came down. So it would have been Wednesday or Thursday. Anyway, a day or two after the election.
Yeah, I think it was just the day after.
But in order to illustrate the importance of this office and the damage that he did during the just shy of 2 years that he held the office, I just want to put this article in here about what he did they'll be some people who won't care anything about the LGBTQ movement. But he rolled back the Obama era drug sentencing reforms in an effort to keep nonviolent offenders locked away for longer. He reversed the policy that limited the Department of Justice use of private prisons, which I find very little support for on our side from people who've been in them. He undermined the consent decrees that the Department of Justice entered into regarding police misuse of force. My city of Albuquerque has agreed to one of those after dozens and dozens of killings of civilians at the hands of police. He undermined the consent decrees and killed agencies that had a history of misconduct and killed a program that helped local agencies bring their policing in line with constitutional requirements. He lobbied against bipartisan sentencing reform, falsely claiming that such legislation would benefit a highly dangerous cohort of criminals. Sessions' attack on immigrants was equally ruthless. He compelled immigration judges to order the detention of more immigrants and punish them when they did not. He barred most victims of domestic violence from seeking asylum in the United States, deporting survivors back to their perpetrators. I mean, we could go on and on about what he has done while he's Attorney General. And so I encourage people to read this article. It talks about him. Now, if you agree with these policies, please write in and tell us this is exactly what you're for. I doubt our people would be for most of this. I suspect on the immigration stuff, since we have a largely conservative audience, they would be for locking down the border and throwing everybody out and jettisoning due process that we've agreed to in international treaties that we've made. But in terms of everything else, these are actions that most of us wouldn't generally support. But yet, this is who we elected, who gave us this administration of this miscarriage of justice during his 2 years that he's been Attorney General.
To frame it differently, as I recall, in the previous administration, the president had directed his Attorney General to take certain crimes and really take a light-handed approach to it. If it's maybe a first time, if it's a very small amount of drugs, perhaps try and achieve a lower amount of sentencing. And I do recall, it was probably about a year ago, we could pretty easily find it, where Sessions sends out a memo to all of the federal prosecutors and says, seek maximum sentencing. I am not trying to sit here and be partisan and go, I'm a libtard or I hate Trump. I'm not trying to do any of that. This is like literally truth. This is what he did. He sent out a memo. I don't personally agree with those policies. I'm on board with you as far as this is what this particular individual has done, as far as us being in the frame of mind of trying to achieve some level of criminal justice reform, fewer people locked up, fewer harsh sentencing guidelines, and so forth.
That's where I'm going with this. He's diametrically in opposition to what we say we're for in terms of reform. The previous administration did try and succeeded in reducing the federal prison population for the first time in 40 years.
Yep.
Federal prison population went down, and it continued to go down in 17 because of the
right
momentum.
Sure.
It's questionable whether it's going to drop again in 18, but if it does drop in 18, I would speculate that there won't be any further dropping because of what has been implemented in terms of charging the most serious crime, stacking charges, seek the harshest penalty that can be imposed. All those things and slowing down the release processes and defunding the halfway houses on the other end, which are, you know, the reintegration centers, all those things will have the cumulative effect of driving the federal prison population higher again. And that is what we say we're not for. But yet we vote for the people who do exactly that. It's amazing to me.
Well, on that, there was a proposition in the Florida election to give voting rights back to people convicted of only certain felonies. I guess you could say convicted of felonies minus a couple. And here's a clip from Rush Limbaugh.
I'm not trying to dump on your parade, but in Florida, it was a very, very big ballot. And Proposition 4, Bill number 4, whatever it called, you know what it was? To reauthorize the felon vote. And it passed. And you know how many of them there are here? 1.4 million who, by virtue of yesterday's vote on something down ballot, are now going to be able to vote in Florida in future elections. 1.4. Now, which party do convicted ex-cons vote for? It's the Democrat Party. I wonder why that is. I mean, which of the two parties campaigns and runs against law enforcement and the prison system? Why? None other than your Democrat Party. So if those 1.4 million felons would have been able to vote yesterday, would DeSantis have beaten Gillum? And would Rick Scott have beaten, what's his face, Stapleface, Nelson?
Stapleface? Really?
Well, I'm glad we found that clip. That is what I'm trying to tell people. Now, 1.4 million people, we won't know how many we're going to actually register to vote. But it would be possible and quite probable that the outcome would have been different. But it sure sounds like Rush, and I don't want to put words in his mouth at all, but it sure sounds like Rush is against forgiveness and giving people full restoration after they've paid their debt to society. And it seems like that he believes that forever you should be disenfranchised.
He brought up a specific point. That's what I got from him. But he specifically says that the Democrats push for policy, like to vote against law enforcement and against prisons.
Yes.
That's mischaracterizing it, isn't it?
It is. And I was going to get to that. But it sounds like that he's a very non-forgiving person. And he has 30 million weekly listeners. Do you suppose any of that transfers over to his audience?
They're probably listening to it and they get guided by it.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is he reflecting his audience, or is he helping formulate their views? But the part about the Democrat Party, and when people do that, that infuriates me. And that's when I say the Republican Party. Because if you can't pronounce our party, I don't have to pronounce your party. It's the Democratic Party, Rush. And it's not that hard to say the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party does not push against prisons and for this law and order. I mean, that is a total mischaracterization, but that's to push the hatred of the Democrats because they're for turning loose a tidal wave of criminality in your neighborhoods.
And isn't it more appropriate to just classify it as they're pushing less hard for prisons and law enforcement?
Well, we're doing, I've bought into the Republicans, love what they say, that a broken system shouldn't have more money poured into it. If we look at our recidivism in American criminal justice, our recidivism rate is off the charts compared to the rest of the world. And the conservatives have said, don't keep putting money into a broken system. So I agree with you. You've sold me. Let's find a new system, just like you say for schools. You say these public schools in inner cities are decaying, decrepit, and we're just throwing more money into a broken system. And we need to find new innovative ways to educate our children. And okay, I want to adopt that philosophy that you taught me so well and put it into the prison system. And the law enforcement side, we keep throwing massive amounts of money that swallows the rest of the world combined to put into our prison system. And it's a massive failure. The recidivism rate is off the charts for most offender categories. Of course, not sex offenders, but for most offender categories, it's off the charts. And I want to re-examine that, and it's a failed system. That's not for wanting law and disorder. I mean, that doesn't mean that you want lawlessness. But
you want people running around the streets and looting, you know, throwing chairs into windows and stealing televisions?
I don't know if anybody. I've lived in minority communities, and I've lived in pristine white communities, and I have not found a community where they are happy with lawlessness. Even where there is lawlessness, there are people who very much are they want that to be taken care of. It's a complex problem, but they're not sitting around cheering that the fact that their homes are being broken into and that their neighborhoods are not safe. They actually want the same thing you want, which is a safe neighborhood. Believe it or not, kids that live in minority neighborhoods, their parents want good schools for them and safe neighborhoods for them. It may come as a shock to you, but they actually do.
Sounds like heresy to me. I can't believe that you're saying that, generally speaking, people want some sort of safe, stable community where they can kind of sort of walk around maybe at night and not have to worry about getting gunned down or raped or whatever. I just can't believe that you're saying those things.
Well, I've heard it expressed from enough people. Like I said, I've lived in some poverty poor neighborhoods where crime is elevated, and we can have a long debate about whether crime is a symptom of poverty, and I believe that there is some contributing factor to when you have poverty, wide scale poverty, you're going to have a higher crime rate. But lawlessness is not something that most people are for.
But apparently, from Rush's program, he thinks that that's what the Democrats are for, which is a pretty gross mischaracterization of what that party would stand for.
It is indeed, and like I say, I find those quotes troubling, that he is so unforgiving. Now, this is a man who had the vast resources of a prosecutor who was overzealously trying to get him, used against him with his OxyContin scandal that he had 10, 15 years ago. And he was able to articulate that the system was vastly, vastly empowered to go after and bring a person down. In fact, in recent programs, he mentioned that the deal that former Trump guy, that cut with prosecutors to plead guilty, Manafort. He said that they broke him down and they bankrupted him. Well, Rush, you're right. They did, and they do. But what have you done with your 30 million listeners to try to educate them to seek some more balance in the system? You have fed that. You have fed that and been irresponsible with your microphone. That's what you've actually done for all these years.
It is very interesting. I remember when Hannity came on. So Hannity I remember Rush congratulating him for getting an 8-figure deal, and he was envious of the 8-figure deal. And I don't know if Rush has an 8-figure deal now, which implied to me at the time he had a 7-figure deal. Hannity's been on for 15, maybe 20 years. So we could probably assume he's got an 8-figure deal. So Rush is making more than $10 million a year. You could probably wear down your local prosecutor with that kind of annual revenue.
The last time I heard him quote what he's earning, and he doesn't quote it very often, but it was years and years ago, and he said it was at $38
million. That is a monster amount of money.
Someone
was ludicrous.
They misquoted it. It was kind of like the offender that got tracked down when he was a serial killer, and the police misquoted how many he had killed, and he called him up and said, "I want to straighten you people out." And more than that, so get it. I've killed more straight. Well, Rush said the person said that he was earning like $28 million or something. He said, "Well, just get it straight." He said it's 38, but who's counting? But I haven't heard him announce that in a long time, and so it could be we could probably Google it and find out. But it whether it's 38 million or 28 million, he would have the power to wear down the prosecution because he could equal them. But bigger than that, he has the power to sway public opinion about the overuse of prosecutorial resources, and he's not doing that. And that would be a service to humanity if he would do that, if he actually had compassion for what's happening to people who don't have 28 million or 38 million or 10 million or even 5 million to fight back.
And I don't want to spend too much more time on this one, but it would – so from a pure journalistic point of view, yes, you have your bents, you have your leaning, but Rush is not a journalist. Rush is
he's an entertainer.
Yeah, he's an entertainer, and his purpose there is to somehow take the feedback from his listeners and push out a message. But I always wonder with these guys, with Alex Jones, with some other ultra, ultra right-wing conservative people that I see, do they believe these things, or are they just pandering to that listener base to feed them that message so we can collect his $50 million a year? I just always wonder if that's the deal.
I believe it's both. I believe that they believe. I mean, they're committed to their political leanings, but I believe it's both. That they're also panicked.
Yeah.
They know who's listening to them, and if like our audience, we'll probably lose somebody because of what I've said tonight, because we've said things that doesn't jibe with what they believe. And we keep welcoming them. You can come on. We'll invite you on. We'll respectful. We won't do what Rush and Levin and those people do if you disagree with us. But they shut you down, they ridicule you, and they belittle you. When they finally let you on the program, then they belittle you, and then they cut you off.
Right.
And you've been cut off for 5 minutes, and they act like they're still talking to you.
Yes.
And especially Levin. I mean, he is so atrociously ugly to people and calls them ugly names. We won't do that to anybody who wants to come on and express a different point of view. I mean, you're welcome to do that, but I disagree.
I would welcome that for sure.
And believe me, we won't interrupt you and talk over you the way they do.
Yeah, I would be all in favor of having some kind of debate on policies and never go into attacking Larry. You're a moron. I can't believe you think that way. No, I'm not going to have that on this program. Hey, are you ready for your propeller hat?
My what?
Propeller hat.
What is that?
it's for the smart kids. We have an article out of Scientific American, so I would call that a propeller head kind of publication. And the article title is "Neuroscientists Make a Case Against Solitary Confinement." Forget that the United Nations, I know that's a freaking hated group by the conservatives too, but the United Nations says that anything longer, I think 15 days, they consider that to be cruel and unusual punishment. Neuroscientists make a case against solitary confinement. Prolonged social isolation can do severe, long-lasting damage to the brain. I clipped out some of the things that happen when you are in solitary. We probably have all seen some videos. They would take monkeys in the cage and they would separate them from their mom. And after a short period of time, they're just freaking rocking back and forth, and they're very erratic in their behavior. And just using that as some sort of visual, if people have seen it. But for good or bad, the brain is shaped by its environment. Memory loss, cognitive decline, depression, cell death in the hippocampus, which is responsible for spatial orientation and emotional regulation. There's just a mountain of things that happen to you if you're in solitary confinement. No contact with anybody other than maybe the prison guards a couple times a day. That's our justice system. And I think that is just, it's an atrocity when you take some people and I understand people get into a fight. They need to be contained. You need some level of security and so forth. This isn't a way to treat human beings.
Yes. I looked at the article that says there are estimated 80,000, mostly men, in solitary confinement U.S. prisons. They're confined to windowless cells, roughly the size of a king bed, for 23 hours a day. Virtually no human contact except for a brief interaction with guards. And what the sad thing about this is that we went on a prison building binge in the 80s. It carried over and into the 90s. If you look at your prison websites, if you look at the age of the facilities, you'll see built 1999, 1993, 1989. And we've got these facilities that were built in an era where the public was demanding harsh treatment. Well, you've got a prison facility that's designed with cells that are not necessarily the right cells. And what I'm trying to simplify is that you can have 1,000 prison beds and you may have only a population of 900, which technically you're not overcrowded, except for if 150 of those are isolation cells, then you're overcrowded.
Right.
If you don't. So what it does is it pressures the classification people to use that bed space, because they hate to go out and tell John Q. Citizen, well, we actually have our prison, it's got a rated capacity of 1,000, and we've only got 922 inmates, the average daily population, but we're overcrowded. Well, why are you overcrowded? Well, we don't want to use the isolation cells. That doesn't get a lot of, go try that in public and tell you at the next town hall how well that goes over. And
sure.
So you have to have the right mixture of beds. And so you have these facilities that have that, where they've built them with confinement isolation cells, and there's a pressure to use them because they need space. If you're going to lock everybody up, you got to put them somewhere.
Well, I know in this area they'll end up putting they call them a boat, so you end up with a little cot, and so a two man room becomes a three man room, or they're stacking bunks three high in some cell houses.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw this in there to go from the scientific side, since I went on my homeopathy rant last week. But here's something that actually will have some evidence behind it, with real scientists and real evidence backing it.
Well, to the credit, there is a movement underway to try to limit the use of solitary confinement, and states are one by one taking action. I expect we will in my state now that we've got a whole different legislative makeup come January, and we're going to have a brand new chief executive, different governor. Some of the things we've been stimming on doing in terms of recreational marijuana, expungement, solitary confinement, we're going to be able to make a lot of progress from the progressive point of view. Now, the conservatives won't like some of the things, but we have the numbers to do it. We right now, we're at levels I haven't seen in decades here of membership in the legislature. We've got 46 House seats out of 70, possibly 47, depending on how a recount goes. And we've got 26 out of 42 Senate seats. And we've got the chief executive. We've got every statewide elected office. And we picked up all three of our congressional delegation. We've got three members of Congress based on our population. And we won all three seats, which is a phenomenal achievement. We never expected to win District 2, at least I didn't. We won that. So we're going to be able to make some progress here. And if we don't, then you will hear me criticizing us. Because if we fail to act now that we have the levers of power at our control, then I will be very disappointed. And I will be looking to find out what we did wrong, because we have obviously elected the wrong people.
Right. Well, before we get out of here, I learned something kind of neat this past week. I was speaking with the executive director of NARSAL, and she was needing help clipping something in Audacity, which is the software that I used to edit the podcast. I was like, well, what are you trying to do? She goes, well, I just want this one little segment. And I looked at the title of it, and she had downloaded last week's podcast. So it was episode 49. And she was presenting it to one of her groups just to try and like spark some conversation. I wanted to give a shout out to these various groups. She said that a Connecticut group is also doing this. There might be some other groups out there. Just wanted to give a shout out. If you are doing that, write in and let me know. I'd just be curious to know how people might be using this. And I appreciate it. And I hope that we can spread the word further.
Me too, Andy. And how would we spread the word if that was our goal? I wanted to double back on something, just make
Go ahead.
Sure people understand that we are not speaking on behalf of any organization. We probably ought to do a disclaimer on every podcast. These views you hear are expressed are merely the views of the cast, and they have not been cleared by, nor do they represent any organization.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney.
So when you get mad at us, it's only us that you're talking to. We're not speaking on behalf of any organization that we're connected with.
But how can people share
it? Grow the podcast.
There is a website.
Very, very carefully, and it's registrymatters.co is how they find us.
And what kind of airplane should they try and dial into to reach us by phone?
That would be 747-227-4477, and leave a voice message that doesn't go on too long, because it will chop you off if you keep going. But 747-227-4477.
And is there an email address that people could write in?
There is. It's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And then what is the best way to support the podcast?
That is to do what Laura just did. Wasn't her name Laura?
Correct. Laura.
Become a patron. And you can do that at www.patreon.com/
Don't do that.
Matters. Patreon.com. Well, you had someone who told you it was Patreon here a while back.
He gave me the propeller head English. He's like, well, this letter comes before this letter, and then after this. I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. But it's just like a patron, but it's a Patreon. Anyway, whatever. Yeah, patreon.com/registrymatters. For as little as a dollar, would love you forever. If you donate more, then I will certainly start sending blue balls your way. And that would be freaking badass. That would make me very happy.
And Laura, thank you for the 20 grand.
Yes, thank you very much. And hopefully that check clears the bank.
Actually, I have no idea what it was. I was just being funny there.
I know. It wasn't 20 grand. So. Well, that's all I got, Larry. I appreciate it as always, and I hope you have a good night.
Thanks, Andy. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.